Welcome to another deep dive. This time we're going to be looking at how we model the world around us, and you know I love a good deep dive, especially when it involves physics, biology, all that good stuff. You've sent over some really cool excerpts from academic papers, and I'm already seeing all kinds of connections.
Well, it's pretty amazing, isn't it, how we humans have come up with all these systems to try to make sense of this incredibly complex reality, right? We're going to unpack how models, signs, and even codes play a part not only in, you know, the hard sciences, but in everyday life.
Okay, so let's back up for a sec. Let's start with, like, the very basics. What exactly is information, and how does it help us understand, you know, all the stuff happening around us?
Well, the word itself, information, comes from the Latin informare, which means to give form. So right away, we can tell that information isn't just, you know, random bits and pieces floating around, but it's about how those pieces are structured, how they're presented to us.
So it's about giving shape to, like, raw data.
Yeah, precisely. Traditionally, we think of information as knowledge, meaning communication. But to really understand how it works, we need to understand signs. Think about a road sign, for example.
Okay, like a stop sign, I'm picturing it.
Perfect. It gives really important information to drivers without bringing, you know, the actual act of stopping to them directly. And that's how signs work. They deliver messages about something else.
So there's always that relationship between the sign and what it's, you know, what it's pointing to.
Yeah, exactly. And this relationship is structured. You have the sign, the object it represents, and the agent interpreting it, right? So our driver sees the stop sign and understands, oh, this means I need to stop my car at a certain point.
Right, right. It's like a three-way connection. Is this where semiotics comes in? You know, that study of signs and symbols?
You got it. Semiotics digs into these sign systems and goes beyond the sign, object, and agent. You also have context, because the same sign can mean different things in different situations.
Right, like how the word bank can mean a financial institution or, you know, the edge of a river. The context tells you what it means.
Exactly. So when it comes to information, there are three key dimensions to think about. We've got semantics, which deals with meaning, how those signs relate to objects, right?
Okay, so with our stop sign, semantics would be like understanding that that shape, that octagon with the word S-O-E-P, means that, like, you messed up your car.
Precisely. Then we have syntax, which focuses on the relationships among the signs themselves. Like, think about grammar in language, how words are arranged to make, you know, sentences that mean something.
So syntax is like the grammar of information, how the signs are structured, how they're organized, even if we don't know what they mean specifically.
You got it. And finally, we have pragmatics, which is all about context, right? How does that play into how we interpret the signs?
So with our stop sign, pragmatics would be like thinking about where that stop sign is placed. Maybe there are other traffic signals around, or even like the cultural norms around driving in a specific place. All of that contributes to our understanding of what the sign means in that situation.
Exactly. It's about how the whole sign system functions within a specific environment, like the unwritten rules of communication in a certain social setting, right?
This really highlights how much we rely on signs and symbols constantly, without even realizing it half the time. It's pretty wild when you, like, peel back the layers and see what's going on there.
It is. And speaking of signs, there's a very helpful way of looking at them developed by a philosopher named Charles Sanders Peirce. He categorized signs into three main types: icons, indices, and symbols.
Okay, now this is where it gets interesting. Tell me more.
So icons are the most straightforward. They're like direct visual representations. The sign resembles the object it represents. A photograph of a cat, right? That's an icon of a cat.
Got it. So what about indices?
Indices are a little more subtle. They have a direct causal relationship with the object, like smoke indicating fire. The smoke wouldn't be there without the fire, right?
Oh, or a footprint in the sand. That shows someone was walking there. The footprint is like a direct result of the pressure from their foot.
You got it. It's an index of both the foot and the person who made it. And then you have symbols, which are they're more arbitrary representations that rely on social conventions to get their meaning across.
Okay, so symbols are where we start getting into, like, human-created meanings, like the letters of the alphabet. Those don't have any, like, natural connection to the sounds they represent, right?
Right.
But we've all agreed on a system that links them together.
Exactly. And those symbolic systems can be different across cultures, just like writing systems differ around the world. Think about how alphabets represent individual sounds, which is completely different from hieroglyphs, where you're using images to represent words or even, you know, whole concepts.
It's amazing how much our communication depends on these, like, these shared understandings of symbols.
It really is. And you know, a lot of signs actually combine elements of all three types. Take road signs, for example. You've got symbols like numbers and letters, icons like pictures of animals, and indices like arrows, all working together to convey a ton of information in a very compact way.
So that stop sign I keep thinking about, it's not just a symbol, it's like a multi-layered sign drawing on all three.
Exactly. And the fact that symbols are arbitrary, that they're based on convention, makes them really powerful. We can manipulate them without needing to refer back to what they actually represent.
So we can rearrange letters in a word without changing what the letters mean individually, and we make a new word, like rearranging the letters in deal to make lead.
Exactly. That's the foundation of how computers work, right? They're manipulating symbols based on syntax, not the meaning of those symbols. Performing calculations, doing operations, all based on the structure, the arrangement of symbols, not on their inherent content.
Wow, that's fascinating. So the way we use language and symbols, it's like mirrored in how computers handle information.
Yeah. And this leads us to an even bigger idea, the idea of codes.
Ooh, codes. Now you're talking. How do codes fit into all of this?
Well, a code is basically a set of rules, right? It establishes a correspondence between two separate worlds. Think about Morse code. It connects those dots and dashes to letters of the alphabet. It lets us transmit messages using a completely different system of representation.
So it's like a translation system between two languages.
Precisely. And get this, codes aren't just something humans invented. They exist in nature, too.
The codes in nature. Now I'm really intrigued. Tell me more.
The best example is the genetic code. It creates a correspondence between DNA, the language of genes, and proteins, which are the building blocks of life, right? It's a set of instructions for building and maintaining an organism.
So DNA is like a code book that our cells use to make proteins. That's mind-blowing.
It is. And the genetic code isn't the only example. Think about signal transduction within cells, how our brains process information, our immune systems recognizing antigens. All of these rely on codes to work.
Wow, so it's like nature has its own languages, its own communication system.
Exactly. And just like we use symbols to formalize knowledge and build models, nature uses codes to organize and regulate all sorts of complex processes.
This is making me rethink how I view the world. It's not just about physical objects, but about the information, the codes that govern how they interact.
That's a great insight. Now let's shift gears a bit and look at how humans have formalized knowledge throughout history, starting way back with the ancient Greeks.
Okay, I'm ready. How did we go from just observing the world to creating those formal systems of knowledge?
Well, think about Aristotle. He was one of the first to really try and relate symbols to the external world in a systematic way. He was looking for rules, relationships, to try to explain the natural phenomena he saw.
Do you have an example?
Well, he was fascinated by physics, right? He proposed rules for how objects fall, relating their weight, the density of the medium to how fast they fall.
So even back then, they were starting to think about how to represent those physical events, those phenomena, with symbols and equations.
Exactly. He was building early models of the world, even if they were pretty basic compared to what we have today. But it laid the foundation for others to come along and build upon those ideas.
And how did those ideas evolve?
Well, then you have Galileo. He made a really crucial contribution. He realized that the relationships between symbols themselves, they could be studied mathematically, separate from the objects they represented.
So he was abstracting those concepts further, right? Focusing on the mathematical relationships, not just on the physical observations.
Precisely. And then Newton comes along. He took that even further. He made this really clear distinction between the symbols that come from observations and those representing those underlying physical laws governing those observations.
So he was separating the what from the why, right? Going beyond just describing what we see to try to explain the principles behind it.
Exactly. He was creating a more abstract framework for understanding the world. And this evolution of thought leads us to a really key figure in the development of modeling, Heinrich Hertz.
Okay, another big name. What did Hertz bring to the table?
Well, Hertz was a physicist, and he really wanted to base mechanics on measurable quantities to create what he called images or models of the world.
So he was all about grounding scientific theory in empirical evidence, what we can actually measure, quantify.
Exactly. And he argued that these models, these images or symbols, they could help us predict future events, right? Because they represented external objects and the necessary consequences that came with them.
So models become predictive tools, helping
Yes.
us anticipate how things will act based on what we understand about the underlying principles.
Precisely. And he had a very specific definition of a model.
All right, lay it on me. The Hertzian definition of a model.
He said a model is a complete and consistent set of arguments, equations, or rules corresponding to a prototype. Basically, a simplified representation of something that's more complex. It captures the essential features without all the unnecessary details.
It's like making a map. You don't need to include every single tree and rock to, you know, understand the lay of the land.
A perfect analogy. And Hertz emphasized that models involve this change in the scale of abstraction. We're going from concrete observations to abstract representations, focusing on those key relationships and principles.
And even though models are, you know, they're simplifications, Hertz found them to be incredibly effective at predicting both physical and social realities.
He did, which brings us to an important distinction: computational models versus thought experiments.
Ooh, a dichotomy. Tell me more.
So computational models, like those Hertz was talking about, they're empirically validated. They're tested against real-world measurements.
Oh.
Grounded in data.
So we're constantly checking those models against reality to see how well they hold up.
Exactly. But thought experiments are different. They're grounded in theory. They're exploring hypothetical scenarios. They're pushing the boundaries of our understanding.
So they're about playing with those what-if scenarios, exploring different possibilities?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. A good example is the field of artificial life. It uses computer simulations to explore those theoretical possibilities of life. Not necessarily modeling life as we know it, but exploring, you know, how life could emerge and evolve.
It's like a virtual lab for testing different theories about the nature of life itself.
That's a great way to put it. It highlights the difference between modeling to match reality and modeling to explore possibilities. And then you have fields that kind of blur the lines, like bio-inspired machine learning.
Bio-inspired machine learning. What is that exactly?
Well, it takes inspiration from biological principles, like how the brain works, right, to develop new algorithms and technologies. It's like looking to nature to find solutions to engineering problems.
So, like, we're learning from nature's designs to improve our own creations.
Exactly. And sometimes these bio-inspired approaches, they actually challenge our theoretical assumptions. They lead to new insights. And then on the other hand, you have fields like systems biology, computational biology, synthetic biology. These are more about building models that are validated through those real-world measurements.
So they're taking all that biological data we have and using it to create models that really accurately reflect that complexity of living systems.
You got it. They're using computational tools to make sense of all those intricate networks and interactions within organisms, those networks that that really make life possible.
This is so complex and so fascinating. We've gone from simple signs to, like, sophisticated computational models, all in an effort to understand the world around us.
And that's just scratching the surface. There's so much more to explore about how we model the world, from the physical sciences to the social sciences and beyond.
Well, before we get too far ahead of ourselves, let's take a moment to kind of process what we've talked about so far. What are some key takeaways for our listeners, especially, say, those who are college seniors, maybe just starting to wrap their heads around these big ideas?
I think a key takeaway is that information is everywhere. It shapes how we understand the world, right? We use signs, symbols, and codes to organize knowledge, to communicate, even to understand the natural world.
And it's not just about the information itself, but the systems we use to process it, to interpret it. We've seen how humans have come up with these increasingly sophisticated ways to model the world, from Aristotle's early observations to Hertz's focus on measurable quantities and computational models.
Absolutely. And these models, they're powerful tools for understanding how things work, right? And for predicting how things will work, both in the natural world and in our own lives. And as we continue this deep dive, we'll explore even more examples of how models are used in different fields, from physics to biology to economics.
This is making my head spin, in a good way. But before we move on, let's leave our listeners with a thought-provoking question, something to ponder.
What kind of models are we creating in our own lives, maybe without even realizing it? And how do those models affect how we see things, how we act?
Ooh, that's a good one. Something to think about as we move into the next part of this deep dive.
Welcome back to our deep dive into modeling the world. Before we took that little break, we were talking about how Heinrich Hertz really wanted to make our understanding of mechanics much more grounded, you know?
Right, like he wanted to move away from all those vague concepts and focus on stuff we could really measure, you know, get empirical with it.
Exactly. He wanted to move away from fuzzy notions like force and really focus on things that could be quantified, measured, and then represented using symbols and equations. This led him to propose that we think of models as as like these images that can help us make predictions about what's going to happen in the future.
So these images, they're like simplified representations of systems that are way more complex in reality, right? Kind of like those maps that just show the major landmarks and the main routes you need to take.
Perfect analogy. And even though these models are simplified, Hertz was just amazed at how effective they could be in predicting how a system would behave.
But he was also careful to emphasize that those models need to be checked against what's actually happening out there in the real world, right?
Yeah.
We can't just come up with these beautiful theories that are totally disconnected from reality. They need to be tested, validated.
Absolutely. He was a huge proponent of empirical validation, making sure that our models are actually reflecting what's really going on. This idea of models as predictive tools, it's super important for how we understand pretty much everything, from physics to biology to even social systems.
Okay, so we get a pretty good handle on Hertz and his vision for models. Now, how does this all tie in with the idea of formalizing knowledge that we touched on a bit earlier?
Well, when we talk about formalizing knowledge, we're really talking about creating systems that use symbols and rules to represent what we understand about the world. And models are a big part of that process.
So when we build a model, we're essentially formalizing some specific aspect of our knowledge, right?
Mm-hmm.
We're taking what we know, we're structuring it, giving it a more concrete form.
Exactly. We're sort of translating our understanding into a way that's more structured and symbolic. This allows us to analyze it, manipulate it, and even test that understanding. It's kind of like we're building a little machine to see how our knowledge actually works.
That's such a great way to think about it. And we can trace this process back centuries, right? We talked about Aristotle and those early attempts he was making to model the physical stuff he was seeing around him.
Yeah. His work was such a crucial first step in the development of how we think about science. He was really one of the first people to try to systematically connect symbols to the world we live in. He was looking for rules, relationships, trying to find things that could explain what he observed.
Like how he was looking for patterns in the way objects fall, trying to relate their weight and the density of what they're falling through to the speed at which they fall.
Exactly. And while his models might seem pretty simple now, they were so important in laying the groundwork for everything that came after.
And then we have Galileo, who took a more abstract approach, right? Focusing on the mathematical relationships between those symbols. He wasn't just describing what he was observing. He was trying to uncover those underlying principles.
Right. He really saw the power of math, how it could be used to represent and manipulate relationships in a really general way. It's almost like he was creating a new language to talk about how the world works on a deeper level.
It's like we're watching the birth of modern science as we go through all of this. And then, of course, Newton came along and refined those ideas even more, distinguishing between symbols that represent those things we observe and the ones that represent those laws that govern them.
He was really trying to draw a clear line between the what and the why, pushing scientific thought into a much more abstract realm where we're not just describing what we see, but really working to explain it.
This whole progression is amazing. We've come such a long way in terms of how we approach modeling the world. And this brings up something really important. The whole question of just how effective mathematical and computational models can be at predicting actual real world events.
It is pretty remarkable. Even though these models are just simplifications, they can be incredibly accurate when it comes to predicting how things will behave.
And this goes for so many different fields. It's not just about physics, right?
Like, yeah.
Think about predicting weather patterns or understanding how populations grow. These models are essential tools across so many different disciplines.
Absolutely. It's almost like we're building these mental maps of reality and then using those maps to figure out how to navigate, how to make decisions.
But even with all the progress we've made, there are still limits to what we can actually model, right? I mean, we can't create a perfect copy of reality no matter how hard we try.
Of course. There's no way a single model can perfectly capture just how complex the real world is. There will always be limitations, always uncertainties we have to consider.
And we have to be careful about how these models are used, right?
Yeah.
Just because we can model something doesn't mean that we should, especially if those models could be used in ways that are harmful or, just plain unethical.
That's such a crucial point. As our ability to create models becomes even more sophisticated, even more powerful, we have to be even more careful about how they're used.
We have to really think about the potential consequences and make sure we're using them for good.
So it's not just about the technical aspects of modeling, but the ethical and societal stuff too, right?
Yeah.
We need to be really critical, really responsible when we're using these incredibly powerful tools.
Exactly. We need to think about the assumptions that are built into these models, who's creating them, and how they might impact different groups of people.
Wow, that's a lot to consider. But it's clear that modeling is really fundamental to how we understand the world and ultimately how we shape it.
Absolutely. And as we keep going with this deep dive, we'll explore some really fascinating examples of how models are being used in all sorts of different fields, from trying to wrap our heads around climate change to designing new medicines.
Okay, I'm ready for more. Let's keep this deep dive rolling. Welcome back to the deep dive. It's been quite a journey exploring how we model the world, from ancient philosophers to like all those crazy computational systems we have now.
It's amazing, isn't it, to see how that human drive to understand, to represent reality, has led to such incredible advancements in modeling.
Before we took a little break there, we were talking about those models, you know, those simplified representations that can often make some really accurate predictions, but can never fully capture all the complexities of the real world.
Right. And we also talked about how those models, like any tool, really can be used for good or bad. Those ethical considerations are something we can never forget about.
Absolutely. But let's shift gears for a minute. I'm curious, what are some of the most, I don't know, striking examples of models you've encountered in your work? The ones that really made you go, whoa.
Well, one that always blows my mind is the genetic code. It's like the perfect example of a natural code, you know? So incredibly complex, but also incredibly elegant in its simplicity. It's like the blueprint for life itself.
Exactly. It's that direct link between DNA, the language of genes, and proteins, the building blocks of everything alive.
And it's essentially the same code with just tiny little variations across every single form of life on Earth.
It really highlights how interconnected we all are. You know, it's like a universal language.
Exactly. And scientists are still figuring out all the mysteries of that genetic code. You know, there are always new discoveries about how it works and how it can be used to understand and even manipulate life itself.
And that's where fields like synthetic biology come in. Right?
Mm.
They're using the genetic code almost like a programming language, like to design and engineer brand new biological systems.
Exactly. Taking inspiration from nature's designs and using that knowledge to come up with innovative solutions for, well, you name it, medicine, agriculture, even stuff we haven't even dreamed up yet.
It feels like we're entering a whole new era of like bioengineering, you know, where we can actually harness the power of the genetic code to shape life in ways that, well, we never could before.
It goes beyond just engineering life itself, right? We're also using computational models to try and understand how biological systems work on an even deeper level.
Like systems biology, which looks at the whole picture, you know, how all those different pieces of a biological system are interacting with each other.
Exactly. Using computational tools to model these incredibly intricate networks of genes, proteins, molecules, all in an effort to understand how those interactions lead to things like behavior, development, even disease.
It's like we're trying to put together this giant puzzle, you know?
Yeah.
And every new model reveals just a little bit more about how incredibly complex life really is.
And those models are leading to some amazing breakthroughs, like new drugs, personalized medicine, even predictions about how ecosystems might respond to climate change.
It's amazing to think how far we've come, you know, in terms of our ability to model the world around us, from simple physical phenomena to the mind-boggling complexity of life itself.
And as our computing power keeps growing, as we gather more and more data, who knows what we'll be able to model in the future? It's a really exciting time to be working in these fields.
It really is. And what's really struck me throughout this conversation is that modeling isn't just something that scientists do in a lab, you know? It's something we all do all the time, whether we realize it or not.
That's a really interesting thought. What do you mean?
Well, every time we make a decision, aren't we essentially building a model in our heads? You know, weighing different options, trying to predict what might happen based on what we already know.
Oh, absolutely. Our brains are constantly creating and refining these models of the world around us. They help us navigate through all that complexity and help us make sense of our experiences.
So we're all modelers in a way.
Exactly. And if we understand those principles behind modeling, from those simple science to those complex computational systems, well, we can become more aware of the models we create and how they influence our thoughts, our emotions, even our actions. It's almost like thinking about thinking itself.
Meta-modeling.
Yeah.
Modeling our own thought processes.
Precisely. And that kind of self-awareness can help us make better decisions, more informed decisions, and hopefully lead more fulfilling lives.
This deep dive has really been eye-opening. I feel like I have this whole new perspective on how we make sense of the world and how we interact with it.
I'm so glad to hear that. I hope everyone listening feels inspired to learn more about models, both in their personal lives and in their own areas of interest, you know?
I have no doubt they will. Thanks so much for joining us on The Deep Dive. Until next time, keep exploring, keep questioning, and keep on modeling the world around you.